It's a particularly good time to talk to Dane Spencer because the current state of the American men's tech team is similar to that of when Dane joined the U.S. team 30 years ago. No consistent wins or podiums for both of these groups, but by the end of Dane's career, 8 years later, Bodie Miller, Ted Ligety, and Darren Ralves were consistently winning races, and Dane got to witness it all up close, both as an athlete and as a coach. Multiple people have recommended Dane to be on the podcast, including some big names. So here he is. Buckle up. And we are back. I'm Jimmy Krupka, and welcome to Arc City. Arc City is officially sponsored by Ski Racing Media. This episode is sponsored by Falls Creek Race Club. I'd also like to thank Sync Performance for supporting me this season, and a shout out to Ski Cosmos, a ski simulator and training center in Vancouver. Learn more at skicosmos.com. Before we get started, I want to apologize for the audio quality of the interview. I was really excited that I got to talk to Dane in person. Interviews just flow so much better that way. But our microphones unfortunately got switched off right before we started, so all I have is the internal mic audio from my recording device. It's serviceable though, and I hope you'll forgive me. Now, without further ado, World Cup skier, Olympian, and longtime coach, Dane Spencer.
Dane Spencer, welcome to Arc City.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we get into everything, I wanted to just walk through, both for like the listeners and for me, what you've done and where you've been when, in terms of ski racing, coaching, and now.
Ooh, so big span.
But we'll make, keep it quick, you know? Like, so you made the U.S. ski team.
Let's just say mid-90s.
Okay.
I made it for 1 year in 94 and then didn't get called back. And then made it again in 96, about the same week I graduated high school.
Okay.
Was named to the C team at that time. And then was on from 96 to 08. And what I did, I competed in four different world championships, one Olympics, 8 years of World Cup, some better than others. Was in the top 30 in giant slalom for four of those years about. Had some injuries, really sidelined things along the way.
Well, I want to get to the injuries too.
So anyways, I was on the team through 08, didn't get renamed. Then I competed on my own, traveling actually with Warner Nickerson.
Yeah.
You know, an old.
The young people don't know that name.
Yeah.
But it's a good name to know.
Yeah, it is. It's a good one, especially for this world, I think.
Yeah.
You know, because he did it the hard way, in a cool way, and made it pretty far. But yeah, we traveled together on and off for 2 years, and then I retired, and then got a call from Sasha Rerick in the, you know, honestly, late spring to see if I wanted to come on for a role with the U.S. team. And
so it was like right after you got cut.
Yeah.
When you retired. That's
what
I mean.
Yeah. So, I accepted it. Didn't have anything else going on. And so I worked with the U.S. team as a coach for 3 years. I was like a Europa Cup, World Cup bridge coach. Did some stuff with the speed team in the middle. Last year was with Ligety quite a bit. Also Tommy Ford, Tim Jitloff, again, back and forth, World
crew.
Cup, Europa Cup. Yeah. More GS crew. And then from there, I ended up taking a private coaching job for 5 years out of Sun Valley. And that guy did actually make the U.S. team for four of those years. So I was still,
so you were pretty, kind of a U.S. ski team coach at that point.
Pretty integrated. And then when that job ended, I stepped out. You know, my partner, Jasmine, went back to physician assistant school, and we had two young kids. And so I was out for a while. But around that time, I started coaching a camp, you know, mostly a summer camp business that also morphed into doing equipment work for athletes as well. And that was with Josh Applegate, also a former U.S. team coach. And so we've been doing that ever since. And that's been steadily growing and, you know, getting more, full time, I guess I'd say.
Yeah. I want to talk about that at some point too, because there's so many kids out there. Like you're just, we'll get to it. We'll get to it. But you're feeling like a hole in the ski race, American ski racing world, where kids are just looking for places to ski and extra camps and lots of resources. But let's start at the beginning. When you were on the World Cup, you know, you've told me a bunch of stories. And one of the favorites that I had was there was a year where everyone either got cut or they all went to the World Pro Ski Tour. And it was like you and a bunch of young guys. Well, right?
Yeah. So the year before the year just before I made the team, I guess 95, 96. Most of the quote unquote World Cup team quit. They weren't having a good time. They didn't get along well as teammates. Again, this is how it was relayed to me. I wasn't there. Didn't get along with the coaches. And so they moved on. And that was the original Pro Ski Tour was still going at that time. So a bunch of them went over there. And so they had a big void. And so it was a pretty good sized group of us, like 10 to 12. Pretty young, like 18 to 21, all got named at the same time and hadn't really done anything, quite honestly. I mean, Bodhi had just appeared out of thin air about 2 months before that and had some amazing results. But beyond that, the rest of us were very unproven.
Uh-huh. The thing I like that you talked about that was there was this momentum you guys had, because you mentioned something about kids now, they look at the progression and they go, well, I just need to make criteria this year, then I'll make it next year, and then eventually I'll get to the World Cup. And you guys were like, well, we have to fill the void now, so we just got to go vertical, basically.
Well, I mean, for us, first of all, back then, it was like the criteria was pretty open-ended. I mean, I didn't hear anything about criteria for years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just kind of selected the team?
It was... Yeah, I mean, we just all basically somewhat discretionarily were selected. I mean,
interesting.
They didn't have anyone. So, I look back. I mean, I want to say I had some top 15 NORAM results, a couple. And I want to say I got 15th at U.S. Nationals and GS, and I made the team.
Okay. You know,
I mean.
So they had no one.
Yeah, they had nobody.
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah, so obviously for us that was cool to get the call up, but we had a long ways to go.
Yep.
But yeah, it was pretty open ended for years. And I will say, like, to go down that track, as we each developed individually, we did start to have our own individual criteria. We had meetings every year and laid out some expectations. Sometimes those had more hard lines to them, but there was no set criteria for everybody.
Yep. Okay.
Which I would say is way better, because this sport, when you put things together and where your track is so wavy, you know, you have ups, you have big downs, it goes kind of all over the place, and every individual is totally different. And there's also a very, very small handful that make it to the level to even be considering that criteria. So I think if you try to keep the door open for each individual in the right way.
Yeah. Which is something they've kind of done a little bit. Like for me, there was a year I had a really bad recovery from my leg injury, and they gave me like personal criteria, and they've done it for other people too, where they say, just get a World Cup spot. It's not technically criteria, but for you it is. But anyway, to go back to that moment in time, you guys improved very quickly, and you were all in the World Cup pretty quickly, from my understanding.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess our third year on the team, we were all World Cup, quote unquote,
which is fast compared to nowadays.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, our first year we kind of sucked, honestly. We didn't do much. Bodhi really sucked that year.
Really?
Yeah.
His first year on the World Cup.
He didn't finish anything.
Bodhi sucked.
No, his first year on the team.
Oh.
I mean, hardly finished anything.
Really?
I mean, honestly, I was on the side of the hill at NORAM Finals when he had finally, by a miracle, finished two runs of slalom, had a great race, and scored this big result, but it was not matched up against hardly anything. And I listened to I guess I won't name names, but I listened to the head coach arguing with Bodie's direct coach, and head coach wanted him gone. And Bodie's coach was advocating to keep him on. And he won out. Bodie stayed on, barely. And then the next race he did was Park City that next fall when he was 11th in the World Cup out of nowhere. So good thing he won that argument.
Yeah. From training with Bodie in those years, like, was, could you tell, like, you know, obviously I've heard a million Bodie stories, but was he just like totally different in training? Like, was he figuring stuff out in training that you guys weren't, or was he a race day guy? Like, what was it like training with him?
Well, he's very hard to relate to. I mean, in basically all ways. I mean, cool. I mean, I loved hanging out with him. We had hilarious times. And I would say definitely inspirational in his own way, but because he was so radically different, just not only with his technique, but also just the way he thought, it was hard to relate to. One thing, I mean, I would always say about Bodie, and maybe didn't appreciate this nearly enough at the time, but he always genuinely wanted us to beat him. I mean, genuinely, straight up.
Because he cared. He wanted you guys to do well.
Toe to toe, put down your best skiing, and whoever wins, hell yeah. I mean, he wanted that. He just, like, what he relayed to us is how to get there, at least for me, who was like, he was speaking a different language, unfortunately, too often, you know? And that's bad on me. I should have been able to translate that better. I think I could do better now.
You know, I've heard that later in his career, when he was doing more speed, he and Darren used to just, Darren Rouse, for listeners who don't know, would sit down and they would do like long conversations of, this is how I think about it, and this is how, these are the words I use for difficult turns or holes in the course or whatever, or the way a course is set, so that when they gave each other course reports, they could understand what they were saying.
That would totally make sense. I mean, I wasn't there for those conversations, but yeah, this segues into another conversation about that time. And one of the reasons one of the main reasons we had success is we did have a very strong team.
Yeah. Because you, Bodie.
With me, Bodie, Chip Knight was on that team, Thomas Vaughn, Tom Rothrock, who's a guy people don't remember that well. And then you had Darren that came in, you had Chad Fleischer. We had a pretty big group, but, you know, the core group was maybe a little bit more slalom GS from our side. You know, honestly, the downhill team had strength with the men, you know, mostly for years.
Yeah.
Whereas the tech team had really dropped off kind of since the Mayer brothers, really. I mean, there were some highlights, you know, Felix McGrath, Matt Grosjean here and there, but not a ton. And for us, we came on as this, you know, more tech team and hadn't done anything. I mean, I remember we started our second year on the team and we had one guy in the top 100 at 99 in GS. So we had two Europa Cup spots, that and nation spot.
Wow. So you guys were in the tank way more than like the US team is now.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we hadn't done anything.
So this is actually a great opportunity to talk about the US tech team right now. We've got River. He finished 11th in the GS standings. We've got one slalom skier at World Cup finals. Yeah, and River is the only GS skier at World Cup finals. I think Tommy Ford would have been there if he'd been healthy. But it's not as bad as it was when you were racing in the beginning, but it's still, there's not that much depth on the World Cup for American men in tech. Is there anything that you guys like did or any advice or anything you could point to?
Well, I'd certainly say, I mean, there's obviously downsides to having no mentorship from other athletes. We didn't really have that.
Yeah.
But there's definitely upsides because you don't get the baggage of mentors. Like, they can be a pain in the ass, you know? They just can.
Because they don't like when you beat them? Or?
I mean, it's an individual sport. You know, it's super selfish a lot of the time. People with, you know, you get prima donnas, whatever. You got people that are just not great. And we didn't have that. So, I'd fully acknowledge it. We were lucky. It was lucky that this group all got named at the same time. that was highly competitive on the hill in dry land, you know, going full tilt all the time. But then after hours, everyone could chill and hang out, play board games, read books, whatever.
Have a life outside of skiing.
Yeah. I mean, it was, and that's key. That's key to not drag the baggage around, you know, be able to, like, when business time is over, it's over.
Yeah.
And we were good like that. And yeah. So I think that just helped us, you know, get better quickly.
Are you looking for your next big coaching opportunity? Join the Falls Creek Race Club in Australia for an unforgettable coaching experience this winter. From late June to mid-September, you'll be responsible for a team of U16 and FIS athletes in an incredible training environment for tech disciplines in both a beautiful and unique alpine setting. Falls Creek is home to World Cup winner Steve Lee and Malcolm Milne. Their legacy is the foundation of a club that's dedicated to developing top-tier skiers. If you have the experience and passion in alpine skiing, this is your chance to make an impact. But that's not all. We're also seeking an inspiring freestyle coach. If you have strong credentials and the ability to challenge your young athletes in both big mountain and park disciplines, we want you to help elevate the next generation of freestyle skiers. For further information and to apply, click the link provided in the description and or email the athletics director, Mike Gould, at athletics.director@fcrc.com.au.
And then Ted Ligety made a pretty big jump kind of on, you guys had made that, your group had made that jump onto the World Cup, and then Ted just came screaming through.
Yeah, he leapfrogged us.
Yeah.
So there was, again, there was the core group of I call it the second tier World Cup guys. That's me, Chip Knight. Shlopi was better than us. So he was.
Because he had a few World Cup podiums?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was. So he was. He was a much better skier. Mm-hmm. The results maybe weren't as good as they should have been. But he's also a really nice guy. So he got put into the second tier group.
You know? Oh, you wanted him included.
Yeah, he's one of the guys that Ted uses as, like, you know, tackling fuel, so to speak, you know. But Ted came in as this, you know, young punk out of nowhere. And we were, you know, having that second tier group like that is so important because, you know, for the most part, like, it is a little bit of mentorship. I just kind of learn the ropes, hopefully, quickly. And again, this is like, it's a luck component. It has to be a good group that can put up with people, you know, and help them. But also at the end of it all, we were totally attainable quickly. Like, Ted could come in and he knew he could beat us.
Yeah.
And then he did.
And then he could say, and that's so such a crucial thing in a training group. You can beat someone, and if they're top 15 in the world, top 5 in the world, you say, well, I'm top 5. I'm good enough to be that good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You get the proof, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not always totally true, but, you know, you can mentally trick yourself into thinking that's where you're at. And that's all it takes sometimes.
Yeah. So then when I've heard a number of these stories at the end of your career and your last years with the team and stuff, but I'm just curious about your independent years when you're off the team. You've been injured very badly, right? You broke your neck badly.
Yeah, so I had one crash in a Norham downhill where I broke my C2 into like 5 pieces, and then also had an open book pelvic fracture and bled out 7 units of blood in that.
You almost die?
Yeah, I mean, like, that close. I mean, like, down to a couple minutes.
Oh, yeah. Were you just like lying on the hill at that point?
Well, I have no memory for about a week.
Oh, really?
Actually, I would say it's more like probably 6 months, honestly, but absolutely no memory for a week. I can't say myself.
You don't remember the moment where you like saw the light.
But my partner was there because she was watching, and then she ended up basically helping to drive the ambulance down the hill because it was out in rural Montana, you know? It was close. It like hinged on some lucky things, and I got lucky there. But it permanently altered that part of my life. You know, I came back and skied again, but some things got broken, you know, upstairs and like down below, that just didn't line up the same anymore.
Yeah. Did you feel that when you were skiing? Like, was it, were you nervous maybe subconsciously to send it, or was it more like you just didn't quite have that body brain flow that you used to have?
Well, truth is, I had a very traumatic brain injury, which was never diagnosed. Like, it was never looked at, but I mean, I didn't recognize my family for weeks, kind of brain injury.
Wow.
It was bad. And then from that point on, honestly, even when I skied independently, I would go and inspect a course and could not remember any of it. Oh, so, you know, for World Cup, it didn't play out for me. Yeah. You know, I needed some kind of easier hills with nice snow.
Did they have a TV at the top during those days so you could just re-inspect while watching?
They did not. No, okay. We didn't have the TV yet. Uh-huh. So, you know, that was a problem. And then honestly, when they put my pelvis back together, my right leg was an inch longer than my left. And that is a total deal breaker at age 28 in ski racing. You cannot handle those kind of alignment changes. And then it caused my knee to fail. And yeah, that was that. Uh-huh.
But you made a pretty big effort to make it back, right?
Well, yeah. So when I got injured and then became apparent I actually could ski again, I told myself at the time I was going to give it 3 years. That was my window at that time. I was like, I need 3 years no matter what to see what happens. And well, the US team didn't have much faith, we'll just put it that way. And I was, you know, done after that first year partway through. And then I was like, okay, well, I'm still doing this. So I found some sponsors, mostly people I knew, and teamed up with a couple other independents, so Warner Nickerson was one, and then honestly Jon Olsen from Sweden. So were two I ended up like teaming up with for a decent amount of that time. And for me, it was key. I mean, if I had just walked away after the ski team cut me, I don't think I would be doing any of this. I don't think I would have stayed in the sport. I would have been too bitter.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you just get kicked to the curb when you're like still broken, you know, when people make some promises to you of what they're going to do, and then they don't do any of that. You know, that's, it'd be hard. It would have been hard. But again, I was set on seeing this through, and for me to go independent and honestly just find out how little I knew about so many parts of the sport, because I just had been in the bubble of the team for so long with people taking care of all this back office work, you know, and suddenly didn't have any of that. And the first year I really struggled. I mean, I had to go all the way back to basic fist races to rebuild, which was also another very good thing. And it's helped me with coaching, the importance of kind of working through different levels in order to, you know, build momentum, build confidence. And, so that first year was a real struggle. I hadn't tuned my skis for 10 years, you know, really. And I just was useless, you know, I was going around asking for advice from techs I knew and this and that. And that just, it was a struggle, but then, you know, got it back together much better by the second year. I'd be lying if I said it was a great year, but, I did have, you know, one or two results that I could be proud of, and that was it. They happened, and it was like, I crossed the finish line. I was like, that's it.
You're done.
That's it. I raced a couple more races, but I was like, that's it.
You just wanted that's that what feeling.
That's why I did this for 3 years, was for that 2 minutes and 18 seconds of time, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And what is that to you? Like the perfect race is it's just when the equipment's working and you're skiing your best and you're sending it. What are the
I still can visualize it in my head, and it was having that freedom of flow and skiing the hill, you know, feeling free enough to not worry about the course and just ski the terrain and pump the terrain, work the ski. And it happened.
Yeah.
That time.
That's cool.
And that was it, because it hadn't happened since I was injured. And, you know, I mean, you know, the sport is, it's an addiction. Sports like a drug, you get that high every once in a while, and so you're always looking for it, and it's very elusive. And
it's like a few times a year, maybe.
Most ski racers can hang their hat on these, probably less than 10 minutes of time grand total their whole entire career of racing. Yeah. I mean, it's a crazy thing, but yeah, that's what it took.
Yeah.
you got that? And I was like, okay, that's good.
And then you stayed in the sport. And you were coaching, and you had all this knowledge from being independent that you'd kind of earned through that process. And then what was it like coaching? You coached Ted Ligety. I mean, I had Mike Day on the podcast who you coached with during that time, I think, right?
Yes.
So I've heard some stories. Did you listen to that podcast with Mike?
No.
No. Okay.
But I will if you want me to.
Well, it's too late now. I just wanted to see like if you knew what we'd talked about. But the was there anything particular you remember from those years?
Well, I mean, so the okay.
So and for the listeners, it was like the what was it like 2010 through 2014 or something?
Yeah, it was
like the years where he was winning globes and beating people by a lot.
It was basically I was with them 2010-11 through 2012-13. So it was just three seasons. And really only two of those were with Ted a lot. The middle one I got switched over to Speed, which was a questionable decision, but yeah, I mean the first year was well, first of all, these the old skis, the 27 meter radius mm-hmm. GS. Ted had just switched ahead that spring from Rossi. So it was all hands on deck. It was also Mike Day's first camps, you know, as a coach for the US team. So, you know, there was quite a bit of stress, I remember. And for me, I just hadn't done any coaching. So I was just trying to learn the ropes. You were an assistant
there.
Yeah, fully assistant, you know, and trying to learn the ropes on things. I mean, I had, set like two courses in my life, I think, when I got to the team. I didn't know anything, quite frankly. I knew skiing, you know,
yeah,
but I didn't know coaching. So, you know, that was interesting, but it was a good environment. You know, you had Mike leading the World Cup team who I had known, you know, Mike had been my coach one year, the Olympic year in 2002. So I knew Mike from the past. So that was good. And then we had Forrest Carey running the Europa Cup team. And so I was crossing over between those two. And that was awesome. And like, yeah, that Europa Cup program then was incredible. I mean.
Wait, let's pause there because that seems like a really hard jump. Is these guys who are really fast in NORAMs and then you throw them in Europe and they have to figure out Europe and Europa Cups and somehow figure out how to make that jump from Europa Cup to World Cup. What are like some key points here that coaches need to have for that transition?
Well, I mean, that's elusive. That's elusive.
But I remember one time you said, oh, you know, that group that Forrest had was successful and Forrest was good at that group.
It was all time. It was all time. That year was all time that I ever saw. And I mean, they had the 25 Europa Cup podiums that year and won all the titles in the NORAMs. I mean, it was unbelievable. And it just was just knocking off.
Nolan Casper was.
And then, well, then Nolan finished the season getting second at the World Cup slalom in Crossegora. I mean, it was like incredible the way that all played out. And, you know, AF Forrest at that time, you know, obviously as 15 years ago, younger coach, you know, not that far off from coaching at Middlebury, coaching a little bit the team, coaching Bodie, you know, independently Team America. So, he was like, you know, a little more lively and he's like Mr. Sports, right? I mean, dude knows sports like nobody I've ever known, you know?
Yeah.
Watches Celtic Summer League every year. I mean, yeah. So yeah, I mean, he knows sport well. And so I think it's good just for a young crew of dudes like that.
He was able to connect with the crew.
Yeah, completely.
And have fun,
you know,
with
just
with
the purely winter. In the sport, being athletic, you know, you know, not just, you know, dictating to the dudes like this, that, and the other, you know, like he understands sport. And so, and didn't care about that other stuff so much, you know? And the truth is, you know, he had Tommy Ekfeld as the assistant, like running the logistics show, which is such a key piece.
Yeah, it is.
Because, you know, if you're like running like a hodgepodge program where like the housing sucks or you don't have housing and you show up and you don't have all the entries in and all these kinds of things, then it sucks, even if you are a good coach. So to have those two together, you had Mr. Stockenblocken and then you had Mr. Sports. And it just worked. It worked. And that was very, it was incredible. And, that, I mean, obviously the culmination was I mean, Nolan Casper won the Europa Cup slalom title that year, which meant nothing for him for a spot, but it meant a lot in terms of success. I mean, to do that, I mean, it's pretty unprecedented. And then, of course, to have that finish with a second at the World Cup was unbelievable, honestly. And you know, Tommy Ford had wins. I mean, it was kind of across the board. So yeah, that was like, so for me, yeah, that entry that year was really cool.
And then working with Ted, was there anything you, like you're still using now, information you learned from your years with Ted, especially when he had that huge successes that you still apply?
Yeah, absolutely.
Competitively or like equipment wise.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was firsthand there to see how important, you know, making equipment modifications to suit your skills as an athlete, how important that was. I mean, you know, he started that summer on those 35s and it was a real struggle. And then he like started tweaking stuff and finding things that allowed him to progress through the ski better. And then suddenly it was there. And then no one could do it. No one was even close. So yeah, that was definitely very valuable to learn that and be a part of that. And, you know, it's like for me, like I was also like very equipment oriented for a long time, but I quite honestly was never quite, I don't know, in tune enough or forthright enough to really take care of all of it and take full ownership of it. And so sadly, like, you know, a certain amount of time, it just became more of an excuse, which was bad for me, of course. And, you know, to watch Ted,
that's a slippery slope.
It's a thing of equipment, you know, it's like, it's a double-edged sword, right? Like on the one hand, it's very important to take care of it and make sure it's like set up as well as it possibly can be for you. But then also know that the other side is you can't, you know, not work on your skiing, of course, you know? And so to see a guy like Ted, like, and granted, I mean, he, because he was as good as he was, he had access to all the resources. So that's obviously a bonus for him, you know, an advantage, but to also take what you have and put it to use and bend it to your will, that made a huge difference. I mean, he was winning those races that year by seconds over and over.
It was nuts.
Yeah, it was nuts. Yeah. I mean, to the point where it was almost uncomfortable to be around because the other nations were so mad.
Really?
I mean, I was the start coach that year, and at the Ultima Dia race, when he won the first run by like 2.6 seconds or whatever it was, I mean, we were watching the live timing and he was winning by, I mean, he was winning by anywhere from, 2.5 to 5 seconds. And at about bib six, everybody up there just threw their stuff on the ground and walked away. They were like, they were so pissed about it. It was very uncomfortable in a good way.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Because there was I've watched that run a million times, and it was, I think it was Hannes Reichelt was still in the top seven at that time.
Yeah.
He was bib one, Ted was bib two, and I think Ted came down 5 seconds in the lead.
Yeah, 5 seconds. This was pre live feed. So we just saw five seconds.
There was no live feed.
So we all assumed he stopped, you know, went out of the course.
Oh.
And the next guy comes down 3.5, the other guy 4, and then Hersher was like the best 2.5, and you're like, oh my God, what is happening?
Wow.
Yeah, no, that was special. That year was pretty incredible, you know. And then because I was coach also at World Champs when he, you know, had the 3 gold medals. And you know, I was the star coach, and like even the GS, he won the first run, like he had been. And the second run, it was starting to deteriorate. You know, it's like World Champs a little later, it's pretty sunbaked. And the report, my job was to get the reports from the coaches and then filter it down to one thing I tell the athletes. And so I heard that it was getting all chewed up. And so I said, hey, you need to give like extra shape this top of the course. You got like a little bit more than what's there. And I watched him push out of the gate, the last guy, and put, you know, an extra like 2 feet of line. And I was like, oh boy, I better be
it's
right.
The GS.
Yeah, I better be right. But he went once.
Wow.
No, but it's cool. I mean, it's cool to also see someone execute what you say. It's rare, you know, and to be that precise with it. And anyways, it was an incredible learning process for me and just experience in general. And so I was able to take some of that into other roles from there on.
That's cool that he trusted you, because that's a lot to trust someone. a lot of athletes, if they don't have 100% trust in their start guy, they want to hear what the coaches are saying to them. They want to hear every detail the coaches are saying to them. But to have him trust you to say, yep, take all the info and just give me one thing. Is that something you like worked up to, or is that something you guys had worked on?
Yeah, I worked on it a bit. You know, and it wasn't every time. Like, guys went back and forth a little bit on what they wanted, but I had to be prepared for it. And you have to be prepared to tell each guy something different.
Yeah.
You know, what Ted wanted was definitely not like what Tommy Ford wanted. So that, yeah, it was a little stressful, but it was fun. And I think guys trusted me. I had a unique relationship just because I had raced World Cup and they all knew that. So there was, you know, a certain amount of trust in just that experience.
Yeah. That makes sense, actually. Yeah. Is there, did you, as an athlete, I've noticed it's very easy to notice when a start coach has nervousness or when they are confident in you. And I've had times when someone to start with me is just nervous. And I'm like, dude, I don't need you to be nervous because I'm nervous. Like, is that something you consciously thought about?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I did my absolute best to stay relaxed. And honestly, for the most part, I was. I mean, you know, one of the reasons I really liked coaching is because it was so much less stressful than racing. So it was all, yeah, like I didn't feel too stressed out ever, you know, for the most part. So it was probably good.
Yeah, that's definitely a good thing.
I've got a discount code for you for Sync Performance. And I love Sync not only because they make great products like my snow pants that have the perfect size and placement of pockets, and they're waterproof and the side zippers never break. I could go on because Sync is improving their designs every year because they get feedback from their ski racing athletes. I literally sit on Zoom and tell them what to change. It's awesome. But also I love Sync because they have always supported independent ski racers like me. And through the Sync Athlete Fund, they help bridge the funding gap in ski racing from U16s all the way to senior racers. You can shop all the great skiing and ski racing products that Sync has to offer at syncperformance.com and use the code ARCCITY15 for 15% off your order.
I guess now the next logical place to go is, by the way, I mean, for the listeners, I told you this before we started, but when I saw Ted in Sun Valley, he mentioned, oh, talk to Dane. But I didn't exactly know the precise working relationship you guys had had. It was a recommendation from the man himself.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Thanks, Ted.
So the next logical place to go, I guess, is like what you've been doing in recent years. You coached a private athlete who was on the US ski team, and now you're running these camps for kids, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, is kind of this gap. Like, there's so many kids out there that want spring, summer, fall training. Are you noticing it's been an increase? Like, or what's like this niche you're filling right now?
Yeah. So again, like, you know, about 5 years ago, Josh Applegate and I connected and I'd coached with him on the US team, and always really respected each other. And yeah, we started this business, World Cup Tech Alpine Racing Performance. And
it's a mouthful.
It's a mouthful. Yeah. We came
to work on your brand.
We came from World Cup Tech. So of course we picked World Cup Tech for our name.
Uh-huh. Logical.
But yeah, we were basically, it started with really going after college athletes and trying to provide summer content. These athletes that are, they're very good skiers, you know, these D1 skiers, very good, you know, very close, you know, it's like the difference between like a development team and a D1 skier is very little most of the time, right? But yeah, you get into that college pipeline and then suddenly there's no summer support. You can, you know, most of them are able to go, you know, to a camp with their home club or something like that, or academy, and get training, but they don't get much direction. And at the end of it all, if they want, you know, if they have any aspirations to keep doing it after college or get out of the college system into a higher level.
Just to have a successful college career.
Or, yeah, of course, that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, getting some more direction in the summer and getting that mileage is critical. And we all know that. So it's even more so for them because they, you know, you go to school in the fall and then you miss a couple critical months. So the more you can beef up on that earlier, the better. So anyways, we started providing camps, you know, we started with hood camps, you know, mid-July, and then we've kind of morphed from there into doing these copper camps in May. I'm putting on a New Zealand camp in August now, and then we do a camp in the fall in Colorado. So, it's mostly who we go after, but we don't discriminate. I get young kids too. It's actually been pretty fun and cool to have anywhere from like, I've had 13-year-olds up to like 25-year-olds all together. Yep. And it's an interesting mix. It's kind of cool. Like there's actually some mentorship that comes from the older guys, and of course some reaching for better skiing from the younger. It's cool. It's good.
Yeah. And you know, I've been to one of your camps, at least one, and there's a lot of that goes on with working through all this kids' equipment because most of it is messed up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do skis and boots. It started with just boots for like 8 years. And then it became more and more clear that if I didn't deal with skis too, and the whole package, a lot of times it just wouldn't work. It's the whole package the whole interface has to work together. Right. And it's not rocket science, and it doesn't have to be crazy customized, but just needs to be normal. And things rarely are. No, I've been kind of keeping track. I've worked on over 900 pairs of skis in the last 3 years, and I've had less than 10 that I looked at them, checked all the different components of it, and they were like, "These are good to go race." So,
and when you say good to go, you mean like, you know, what are the components? Base bevel, stack height, what else?
Fore aft mounting position, ramp angle, and the binding. Yeah. Those are the big ones.
Yeah.
You know, even you can go into sidewall prep, second edge prep.
Oh yeah.
All those things.
Then you're starting to look at side bevel even.
Correct.
Which you would think is almost always right, but
it is shockingly hardly ever.
Really?
Right. Yeah. Very, very rarely is it sitting right at, let's say, 3 degrees.
So to the kids out there that think they can just pull a 3 degree file all the time and it's always going to be 3 degrees, what are they missing?
It's almost always
yeah,
the sidewall and second edge preparation
have not been pulled enough.
It's like anything, it's all about the prep work, and then the finish work is easy.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, there's a real disconnect there. And not to make huge generalizations, but there's a cultural disconnect of just the value and importance of having the equipment just set up properly and consistently, not only day to day, but year to year. So that, again, an athlete can build that foundation of skiing on something that's the same every year and keep building another layer of complexity as they understand more and can take on more. But when you have ski set up one way one year and completely different the next, you're starting over. And what you find is somewhere down the road, someone's technique gets a little out of whack. And you see it a lot in the US, and we like to just, you know, glorify it as being like, oh, well, look, we're unique. It's like, actually, that's not the case. You know, these kids aren't even allowed to build like some good, solid, traditional foundation skiing.
Because just year to year, their equipment can be so different or so messed up.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about that is you hear so many kids say, well, I'm going to try different skis. These skis just aren't working for me. Different brand. And they don't even consider the possibility that maybe their skis are a 1.5 degree base bevel, which is unskiable, or whatever, for whatever reason, their stack height's messed. Like there's a million things be messed up on their skis that would make them different from a year before, or even just 6 months before.
Yeah, you know, you see it. I see it all the time. You'll find these skis that are getting sold, that you get them, and they're the bevels, especially, are just wrong, not even close.
Yeah.
And then you redo it, and then they're perfect. Ski great. Yeah, yeah. It's like there's this disconnect on just that basic part. You know, let's start with that.
Yeah.
And for me as a coach, I want to start with variables I can control. So if an athlete is struggling in some way, I want to evaluate that first. Let's just make sure that is in a good place. so that if I'm coaching them, they are capable of doing it from the equipment standpoint.
Yep.
And if that's not capable and I don't do that, then I'm a bad coach.
How easy is it? Because to notice, I had this circumstance where I was training indoors, super icy, and my coaches kept telling me to be on the outside ski. And I was like, man, I'm really trying to the point where I was just doing some really awkward stuff. And I didn't know how to tune very well at that point. So I wasn't pulling the side edge. So every time I filed, I was slowly going from 3 degree to 2 degree. And so suddenly I was skiing on spoons and there was no amount of outside ski pressure was going to get me to grip. But the coaches couldn't seem to recognize that. Like, how hard is it as a coach to watch a skier and say, oh yeah, something's wrong with their equipment?
Apparently it's hard because nobody does it.
Yeah.
I mean, again, that shouldn't be hard.
Do you find it easy or at least reasonable to look at a skier and?
Well, I was an athlete. You know, okay. I was there, you know, I went as far as I could. And granted, I can easily look back. I mean, my career was completely dictated by equipment things. I mean, over and over, good and bad. So I am sensitive to that. But it's just, I want to think of myself, I'm an athlete advocate. I'm going to start with the assumption the athlete is doing their absolute best to go fast. And if they can't, then I'm going to deal with that first. I'm going to look at it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think everyone should do that.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows, like, you make an equipment change that's for the better and you can get, you know, 1 to 2 seconds faster in a day. Like, technique wise, 1 to 2 seconds, we're talking about 5 years. I mean, let's just go again. It's low hanging fruit I talk about this a lot in coaching, like going after low hanging fruit things. Equipment is a big one, you know, and I'll be the first to admit, like, it gets more and more difficult, you know, as you have more and more skis and you're looking for smaller and smaller slivers of time, you know, it can definitely be a rabbit hole a little bit there. But it's definitely a time that's well spent, you know, and again, it's certainly an easier way to find time than, the technique side. It's hard.
Okay. So for people at home who are probably over any skiers at home who are overthinking their equipment at this moment, I know that canting is a big one, but it's hard to look at your boots or use a measuring device and figure out canting. The other one is base bevel. Again, really hard. And even you, who's looked at 1,000 pairs of skis and their base bevels, you can't get it to within, you know, you still have a margin of error.
Sure.
So like, what are like kind of two basic steps kids can take with their boots and their skis with base bevel to like figure it out, somehow get it to make sure that it's at a decent point?
Yeah, I mean boots. I mean, if you want to be really low budget, you can get, you know, a square. You know, and you can just try. I mean, I always say, and this is a total generalization and guess, but 9 out of 10 athletes, if you get the boots just at neutral, sitting straight up and down at 90 degrees, that'll work. It'll work well. It's kind of what it's designed to be for the most part. And then, you know, 1 out of 10, you need to make changes because they just don't line up that way. But yeah, I mean, that would be a classic starting point. Mm-hmm. You know, get a square, make sure the center line of the back of the boot lines up there. And then, of course, the other big one is having a nice flat surface and make sure that the sole of the boot is nice and flat sitting on that surface. And if it's not, then getting it flattened to do so.
Yeah, you don't want it wobbly.
And it wobbles bad.
Wobbles bad.
You know, wobbles bad. And then, yeah, with skis, I mean, I've made my own, a variety of different like tools that have a digital, you know, angle finder for the bevel. That you can totally make one.
Yeah, I've seen yours. Yeah, it's simple.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. I mean, I'll be honest, like that realm is a little more difficult. Part of it's just because, you know, your average athlete just doesn't have enough skis or ski work to get really experienced at it. Whereas like, you know, like what I'm doing now where you see hundreds of skis and you look at them all, you get a much better eye and much more comfortable doing that stuff. I mean, not to sound like I'm pushing my business, but like,
yeah, I'm trying to.
But just a big thing is just finding someone you trust and knows, cares about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And isn't doing it just to make as much money as they can in October, you know?
100%.
So that's a big part. And again, like I just tell everyone, always be skeptical, you know, even if you have someone you really trust, do your best to double check it. Get comfortable with doing that stuff yourself as much as you can, you know? Because even people that are good make mistakes, and you just, yeah, you got to trust yourself, because at the end of it all, you get in the gate, it's all on you. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, keep it as simple as you can.
Yeah. Interesting. And I guess for those who don't know, if your base bevel is high, it means the ski is not aggressive. And if the base bevel is a low number, like 0.3, it means it's really aggressive. It means basically that the edge is completely parallel with the base of the ski. So the instant that you turn this, like put the ski on edge, your base edge is digging in. And the way to, it's easy to make your base edge a higher number, because you just take a file or a diamond stone to that with a base edge guide. But in order to get your base edge from a high number to a low number, you actually have to get the skis reground in a machine.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so obviously when you get that, and you know, like bevel will increase over time just from wear as well.
Yeah.
You know, especially early season, you have, you know, less snow and some grit in the snow. It'll just be more abrasive. So yeah, that bevel will increase over time. And so it's, yeah, it's good to, you know, check that intermittently. In a perfect world, you would pick a set number of runs you take and you check it, and you do that again after the next and just kind of get an idea of how quickly they wear. But yeah, you know, let's say you want your skis at 0.5 degrees. Well, once they get up to 0.8, let's say, I give myself like a tolerance of a couple tenths of a degree.
Yeah.
Once it gets to, I'd say beyond 0.2 from your, where you wanted it to be, you should look at doing a grind.
Yeah.
To get it flat. Now there's a whole nother like can of worms, you know,
because they don't always do it right.
Well,
I've had bad grinds before.
Yeah, I mean, it's rampant. It's rampant in the U.S. In the U.S. especially. I mean, it can happen anywhere, but the truth is, you know, this is another huge disadvantage we have to Europe. Where Europe, we're racing so big, and these, you have these machines that can be just dedicated to race-oriented skis. The machines and the stones that do the work stay in much better shape, so you can get much more consistent grinding done. In the U.S., I mean, these machines cost, I mean, first of all, they're European, so they cost a lot. I mean,
they gotta ship hundreds.
Well, yeah. And they're hundreds of thousands of dollars, and that's a big bill you got to pay. So that means you're going to grind anything that comes in the door. And when that happens, the stones just get out of shape, you know, and then you suddenly put a race ski in the mix and that tolerance isn't there. It's not. You know,
it's not enough. The fine tuning that you need.
Yeah. So you got to have someone that's like really passionate about it.
And does the scheduled maintenance, the new stones, calibration, all of that.
Yeah. And then, you know, they do a thing called redressing the stone, you know, and it's where the tool makes the stone dead flat again. And it's how often you do that. And some people, there's no question, some places push the envelope on how often they do it. Because every time you do it, it takes off a layer of stone. Those stones are expensive. They cost thousands of dollars too, on top of your $700,000 grinding machine. So, yeah, it's all what the market will bear. And your average person out skiing on some all-mountain ski, you know, at some Icon resort, like,
yeah, they don't care.
They don't know anything.
They don't know anything.
Yeah. The skis don't even arc. So, you know, when your skis are getting ground at the same place as those, it's like, it's a dice roll at best, with weighted dice towards snake eyes, it seems like. But no, I mean, I have a guy here that runs a shop in Salt Lake that I have a really tight relationship with. He has a ski racing background, really passionate about it, and it's made a huge difference. And so now I can get things into a very, very close range, and I can double check, touch things up, and we're good. Gotcha. I haven't had anything yet that wasn't good.
That's good.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned Europe, how things are better in Europe. And I know before you've told me, you think the skis we get from European, well, all the ski companies are European, but the skis we get from Europe as Americans are generally the worst of the bunch.
Well, again, just to revisit how I said, always be skeptical.
Yeah.
So as a skeptic, which, you know, gets me into trouble in other parts of my life, but on this front, you would be naive to not just assume that Europeans making the skis in Europe for a European sport are going to send us the worst ones. I mean, again, it's just like a bunch of old school materials like pressed together, and they check them and things don't come out perfect all the time. And yeah, those ones that have blemishes, North America pile, you know? I mean, that's what I would do if I was Austrian. I mean, come on, you're playing to win. That said, I mean, again, if you're just have a system and you're meticulous, you can check those skis, find the blemishes, fix them, and have a ski that's as good as anything. But you have to be a skeptic and actually do that work. And that's rare. Mm-hmm. And that goes all the way up to the top of the food chain in America. I mean, the U.S. team has a bunch of problems on that front. And
yeah, that makes sense. And to give people hope who, if they don't have the resources or the time or the access to knowledge to get their skis completely ship shape, to give people hope, like I've heard a million stories of huge successes on skis that were totally messed up, like, you know, quote unquote messed up skis. Like, have you seen people have success on skis and you look at them later and you go, I don't know how you ski these. These are messed up.
I mean, I could tell a story about myself from my time, long time ago.
Yeah.
I skied for Rossi and I had a big crash and totally destroyed one of the skis and had to have like a 6-inch section of the edge replaced underfoot plus a big base weld like cut put in. And Rossi sent me some new skis. So I gave those skis to my teammate. And then we go to the next race and he beats me in these two races in a row. And he had never beat me in anything ever. And I'm getting like 80th place at these races. I mean, it was like so bad. So finally, the third race, I switched him back for those ones.
The skis with the big mark on them.
Yeah, and I got fifth. And he was like 11 seconds behind me on the skis I had been skiing on. And then I took that pair of skis and skied for a whole nother season and made the US team on that pair of skis with the huge base repair and edge repair. So yeah, I mean, those were messed up. Those are messed up, but they were good skis. You know, if you have skis that are good, they can get pretty abused. And, you know, cause it's the setup of the ski, you know, and the angles and all that is important, but the construction of the materials that were used, no question, is important. And I see it. I work on all these skis and, you know, the good skis, just the quality of the metal, when you go to do base bevel pulling or side edge pulling, it's so different than the skis are like that kind of that next tier down.
Interesting.
So, of course, I'm not going to pretend to know what the easy way to get that is. You know, there's always ways, but I would say even finding used higher quality skis is way better than brand new lower quality. And you can usually get them for like a much better deal.
Yeah, the old black market. Yeah. Yeah. Don't let the ski reps know.
Well, yeah.
Depending on what your contract is.
Yeah. No, I thought we were all in it because we love the sport, but hey, whatever, ski reps.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're kind of wrapping up here near the end. We talked a lot about equipment, but that was also, I wanted to talk about it because you're a brain that I wanted to pick on that stuff. At the end of the podcast, I always give guests a chance to say anything they want. You've got a platform with people listening. If you want to say anything else you wanted to talk about or anything you wanted to plug, the floor is yours.
Boy, I mean, we had a pretty wide ranging. Well, I shouldn't say that. We covered most of the bases of what I do. I mean, I've been working with all different levels now. And I do, you know, I've also, actually, this would be a good thing to discuss. So I've, the last couple of years, and this has been like spurred on to me a lot by Josh Applegate, who I work with, just the value of free skiing with directions, so directed free skiing. And so for me, I do, you know, we do the summer camps and do a lot of equipment work, you know, especially in the fall, but it kind of bleeds through the whole year a little bit. But then in the winter on snow, I've been doing these, you know, more directed free ski blocks. And so like the last 2 years before this was with US team athletes. You know, it was Jackie Wiles from the US team 2 years ago. She had missing a whole comp season for return from injury. We did, you know, 45 days or so pure free skiing, just working on
45 days of free skiing.
Yeah, 45 days here. And that was that year it snowed 900 inches here. I mean, running gates wasn't even an option. I mean, she would, every time she drove into town, it would dump 2 feet and then we'd be out on jet skis trying to like, I mean, it was challenging, but she hadn't done it. She hadn't really free skied for years that much, honestly, and definitely not with any direction, you know? And so, and honestly, some of her just understanding of technique and terminology and how, you know, the flow of movements through the turn was stunted, needed some. So, I mean, honestly, some of the most valuable time we had was the chairlift rides, talking about skiing, you know, looking at video, that kinds of stuff. And yeah, we skied no gates. But at the end of it all, she got, you know, got back into the fold with the team, got her first day back in gates in May, had the fastest time, you know? So there was
first day back in gates.
First day back in gates. So it was a testament to the, just the value of, you know, get like skiing with intent in a free timing environment as well. You know, because let's be honest, like skiing free and like clean with the right movements in a course is so hard.
Yeah.
So you should start by like really working on the stuff out of that environment and getting a lot of repetition to get it to be more intuitive. Like any changes you want to make so that when you get into gates and you have that timing is so different and so demanding, hopefully that intuition you've built just is
automatic.
There, is yeah. there, you know, and understanding like it takes a lot of time. So yeah, anyways, we did that. And then I worked with 4 different athletes last year with Josh, from the US team, you know, and with Katie Henzian, you know, Brian, Ava Jemison, and
Finnegan, so you're basically Finnegan-Donley. Contracted out by the US team to do these return to snow.
Correct. That was through last year. And, you know, I mean, all 4 of them had great improvements during it. 2 had setbacks outside of our purview. But yeah, I mean, obviously Katie and Mina had great results right off the bat. And I just, to me, it was a testament to the importance of starting from the ground. You know, and for them, it was injury returns. We start from the most basic things, you know, like sliding without setting your edges at all on these skis. I mean, that's harder than you think, you know, to not set your edges.
Yeah.
It takes a pretty precise vertical movement. But, you know, and again, just lots of talking through skiing, evaluations of equipment, trying some different stuff. And yeah, it was cool to see. So, yeah, I keep doing that. It's really fun. This year has been way more just with local kids, and it's been really successful. And so I'm gonna keep doing it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, it was fun to talk. Thanks for visiting Park City, Dave.
Yeah, you're welcome, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on. And yeah, it's always good to see you.
So if you've been following the sport for a while, I mean decades, you'll notice that the average age of professional ski racers when they retire has increased dramatically over the past 50 years. And part of this has to do with the change in amateur status rules. Basically, before 1971, no athlete could accept any sort of benefit for performing their sport. The long-standing exception seemed to be athletes from Soviet bloc countries who were often employed by the state, military, education, public service, and essentially just devoted most of their time to training and competing. But almost no Soviet bloc alpine racers were in contention for gold medals at the time. Anyways, in 1981, the IOC created the Olympic program, which allowed athletes to get endorsements without losing their amateur status. And then by the 90s, there was little distinction left between amateurs and professionals. But until the 90s, it was hard to earn a quote-unquote legitimate income while being competitive at the highest levels. a few pre-1971 examples of Olympic gold medalists in alpine skiing and their age at retirement from ski racing. 1948 gold medalist Henri Aurier from France, 26. 52 medalist Stein Eriksen, 26. The 1956 triple gold medalist Tony Seiler retired at 23. Jean-Claude Keeley and Nancy Green, the gold medalists from 1968 Olympics, retired at 24 and 25 respectively. And then in 1980, the gold medalist was Ingemar Stenmark. He retired at 33. 84 Olympic champion Phil Mayer, 26. 88 Olympic champion Alberto Tomba, 31. 98 gold medalist Herman Meyer, 36. 2010 gold medalist Bodie Miller, 40. And the 2010 gold medalist Lindsey Vonn is 40 and still racing. Also, a special shout out to Johan Clary for getting second place at the Kitzbühel Downhill the year he retired at age 42. I'll note that some racers, such as Keeley and the Mares, raced on the pro circuit in the 80s after leaving the quote-unquote amateur World Cup circuit. Obviously, we could do a much more systematic analysis for real numbers, but the rough picture is pretty clear, if that makes sense. This might be the most exciting time to watch ski racing. The field has never been deeper or more competitive. And due to financial opportunities and advances in sports science, athletes are staying in the sport way longer than ever before. I heard this stat the other day. I think it's right. Almost half of the top 60 male slalom skiers on the World Cup start list have a World Cup podium to their name. So the climate might be warming up, but the sport is still improving and the competition is just getting deeper. Well, that brings us to the end this time. Before I go, just a quick reminder that you can find my brand new Arc City merchandise on the website, which helps support the podcast and my ski career, and 5% of all profits goes to the Share Winter Foundation. You can also help me out simply by sharing the podcast on social media or by telling your friends about it, and I really appreciate that. There is just one episode left this season, and I'm hoping for a good one. Until then, don't forget to buckle your boots, tighten your straps, and keep your sidewall pulled back. I'm Jimmy Krupka, and thank you for visiting Arc City.